Call the House Energy Committee meeting to order. Today is Thursday, March 19th, and the time is 1:05 p.m. We have with us today Representative Edgemond, Representative Kopp, Co-Chair Representative Holliday, and myself, Co-Chair Donna Mears. Please remember to silence your cell phones. And as a reminder, staff and members of the audience may not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Griffin Plush. And I'd also like to thank Representative Holland's Energy Committee aide, Tim Truer. In addition, helping us out today, we've got Recording Secretary Cheryl Cole. Thank you, Cheryl, and Renzo Moises from the Juno LIO. On today's agenda, we only have one item, but lots of folks excited to be here for it, which is adopting and reviewing a committee substitute for House Bill 369, which is the Energy Committee's omnibus bill. First off, Representative Kopp, do you have a motion for us?
Yes, Co-Chair Mears, I move the Energy Committee adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 369, Work Order 34-LS1521-G, as a working document.
And I will object for purposes of discussion. We will start off with just a quick summary of changes. So, Representative Holland, Mr. Truer.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe even condensed. Okay. Sounds good.
Great. Thank you to the co-chair. For the record, Representative Kai Holland, House District 9. Through the chair, I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to introduce this committee substitute for the bill. Version G of the bill resulted from sharing draft language with numerous stakeholders, including utility partners, the Rail Belt Reliability Council, and other community members, as well as from discussions with committee members. As promised, it includes new sections incorporating improved content from the House Bill 252, the Utility Right-of-Way Wildfire Liability Bill, and additional sections with G that have gone through a series of iterative rounds of discussion. I'm looking forward to getting into the details and going through the series of changes. I'd like to, if we can, pause for now to see if we want to adopt the CS before we dive into all of the details, or we can continue on.
No, I've got an objection for discussion. So I will remove my objection to the adoption of the CS. Any further objections to the adoption of the committee substitute? Seeing, hearing none, congratulations. We have adopted the CS. Co-Chair Holland, Mr. Truer, please continue with your presentation.
Great. Thank you for that accommodation at the beginning. I know we're trying to work with some other schedules. So while a great deal of work has gone into this bill, I also want to acknowledge that it's not yet perfect. I want to thank our friends at Chugach Electric Association for their letter highlighting their recommendations for additional changes. And I'm sure we'll hear from our invited testimony later that there are additional areas where they see room for improvement in the bill. We just got the vote for the CS, so I will jump past that and turn this over to a Chief of Staff and Energy Committee aide, Tim Truer, who can now begin to go into the detailed changes with this version G.
For the record, Tim Truer, staff to Representative Kai Holland. Through the chair, I would like to thank the House Energy Committee for the opportunity to present version G of House Bill 369, work order number 34-LS1521-G. Turning to slide 2 of this presentation, we have a high-level overview of the changes made in version G. In a second, we'll go through the section-by-section explanations of changes. But for now, high level. As promised, we added language originally derived from House Bill 252. But again, as I'll note later, that language has gone through extensive revision. We also pulled out the section related to plug-in solar, as several stakeholders felt that House Bill 257, sponsored by Representative Eichheit, was the better vehicle for exploring concerns around plug-in solar devices that were raised before the committee. With input from a variety of sources, there are a number of changes in version G related to the role of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and the Integrated Resource Plan produced by the Rail Belt Reliability Council, the RRC. Briefly, these include removing a section of version A that would have tasked the RCA with a process of determining a best value for diversified energy projects. We felt that was duplicative of a process used in developing the IRP. These changes also include removing a section that would have pre-cleared diversified energy projects with the RCA, which may have inadvertently undermined the IRP process. We also, these changes include removing a section that would have tasked the RCA with promulgating a rule around economic development rates, which seemed perhaps excessive when the RCA has a process on a case-by-case basis for approving reduced electricity rates in cases where excess renewable electricity was available. We also amended a section that would have allowed renewable energy projects less than 15 megawatts of capacity to renewable energy and storage projects to skip certain RCA approval processes should they have approval from the relevant utility board. The new cap is for projects 7 megawatts or less. And then regarding the diversified portfolio standard, we again made several changes. These include simplifying the multipliers for meeting the standard. So now there's just one. It's a 1.5 multiplier for now all diversified energy projects that are greater than 100 megawatts in scale and shared between utilities. And we thank the committee for input that was helpful in directing that change. For projects seeking to qualify as diversified energy resources through the final option that's outlined in the bill, namely proving that the life cycle emissions of the project would be less than 100 kilograms of carbon dioxide equivalent per megawatt hour of electricity, we now have shifted that so that certification comes from a third party in an effort to reduce burden on the Department of Environmental Conservation. And now moving to slide three, we start.
I'm going to take a moment to welcome Representative Costello about 106 and Representative Ruffridge at 12 after.
At the end of each slide for questions.
Okay.
Whenever you're ready, please proceed.
Great. So for the rest of these slides, I'll be going section by section through the changes in this bill. I'll pause at the end of each slide for any questions. Slide three. Also, I'll note that we'll be paying the most attention to sections two and three, as those are the sections that have the meat of the language from House Bill 252. The full title of the bill has changed to reflect sections that have been added or removed. And then in section one, we made some changes that you see here to the uncodified portion of the Alaska State Energy Policy. These changes include clarifying an energy efficiency target for the types of efficiency that we mean. Also, we removed the diversified energy target from this uncodified language section to not cause confusion with the inclusion of that language in a statutory section of the bill. We removed a target around the Power Project Fund as that felt like it perhaps was dated and more reflective of a different of the previous version of the state energy policy. We removed a reference to critical minerals that felt extraneous, and we clarified some language around the goal of achieving the average U.S. price for electricity in the state of Alaska. Okay, and slide four. Now we're getting into the language that is originally derived from House Bill 252, which the committee has heard before. Again, it's gone through several rounds of feedback before the introduction of that language here. But also, again, we expect some additional clarifications or tweaks before this committee moves a final version of this bill out of committee. This section two addresses liability for wildfires originating from utility rights of way. Specifically, the section outlines how any utility that adopts a wildland fire mitigation plan or wildfire mitigation plan gets a limited liability protection. And the details here include that there's a The language here would create a presumption of non-negligence when a utility adopts one of these wildfire mitigation plans and is complying with it, except in cases of gross negligence. And reflecting comments from members from discussion in this committee, we've also added language that would clarify that the standard would be just negligence in cases of civil liability. This section would also indicate that the liability protection exists when risks for contact between vegetation and utility facilities, so for example, a tree falling on a power line, was not foreseeable during the last survey of vegetation by the utility or their contractors, or if that vegetation sits on an adjacent property and that property owner was notified in writing of the risk of that vegetation. The section goes on and also indicates that if vegetation is removed from an adjacent property unnecessarily, in a way that is deemed unnecessary, the liability to the utility is capped at the replacement value of the vegetation removed. And the section also explains that there's some exceptions, such as when the utility directly causes vegetation power line contact through their work or fails to meet their obligations in their own right-of-way or conducts unauthorized work. Great. And then so moving on to slide 5, section 3 of the bill is where we explain the required elements of a wildland fire mitigation plan. These elements include that the plan must be in writing, must describe the property where the utility operates and the adjacent properties. It must be updated every 3 years, and it must be on file with the Department of Natural Resources. Previous versions of the previous version of 252 had a approval role for the Department of Natural Resources. Now it's just they have the opportunity to offer comments. They may offer comments, and the plan just needs to be on file with them. The wildland fire mitigation plans must assess the risk of a wildfire starting in the area defined under the plan that the utility is responsible for maintaining, or the risk of a fire starting outside of that area and spreading into it. The wildland fire mitigation plans must include procedures for inspection and maintenance, for de-energization of the power lines, of vegetation management, of fire detection, of emergency notification, and of maintenance of access routes in a case of an emergency. A utility must notify the Department of Natural Resources and adjacent property owners and occupants of high-risk vegetation, of any high-risk vegetation conditions specifically that were encountered during a vegetation survey as outlined in the wildland fire mitigation plan. A utility may remove vegetation outside of its right-of-way that poses an imminent risk of fire. We're not aware of anywhere else in statute where that is already allowed explicitly. And the Department of Natural Resources may review and consult on a wildland fire mitigation plan. It must acknowledge receipt of the final plan, but don't have, may review, but don't have an obligation to review these wildland fire mitigation plans. And finally, a utility must publish a wildland fire mitigation plan 60 days before its adoption and provide a 30-day public comment notice for it to be considered a full wildland fire mitigation plan for the purposes of this legislation. Any questions there before I move on?
Representative Kopp.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. It's a great, great overview. More just kind of initial first blush. It says the overall package is softer in tone, I think, than kind of how it was rolled out. And I appreciate Representative Hall and the work you did there on that. The language there talking about avoiding undue economic harm to ratepayers, I think, was missing in the earlier version. And I appreciate that because I think that gets into you know, affordability of energy, which I think is really important. I've always kind of been stuck on the IRP first thing, which I'm still struggling with. The sequencing seems like we're still looking at policy and then kind of forcing the IRP to fit. So we could continue to talk about that. We do expect that to come out soon, and look forward to hearing what the utilities think about the right-of-way, you know, responsibilities, duties, and if we've kind of we've got that right. I think you and I talked about the possibility of incorporating some tool in the law for utilities to be able to serve notice on a landowner that a observed hazard is of such a nature that if they don't react within a certain time to correct it, it's literally like a liability transfer from the utility to the owner saying, hey, we pointed this out to you. We've clarified this is why we think it's severe. And if action isn't taken in this time, basically what would otherwise be on us is now on you. And have you looked into that any further?
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Through the co-chair to Representative Kopp. The current language indicates that the utilities would notify the landowners of that adjacent property of that hazard. And later on, the language clarifies that the utility is not liable for the damages associated with a fire that might have come about because of that vegetation that they had observed and notified somebody. We didn't put the language in there with the time frame, though, and here's why. One of the issues we've been trying to navigate carefully with the input of the utilities is how to make sure that we're not inadvertently creating extra liability on their part, the utilities' part, for this work that we're doing. This is intended to be beneficial to the utilities, beneficial to the ratepayers, but helpful to the community that this information is getting out. If we, for example, required a timeline that said we're going to notify adjacent property owners of this situation and they, you know, have called 30 days to do something, and if they don't, then we can come in and do it. We implicitly then create a liability on the utility to then go and do that work. And that's where we really pulled back in a number of places of trying to provide the opportunity for the utility to share the knowledge that they've gained about the risks and the hazards, but we're trying to thread the needle so that we're not adding to their obligation and their cost of maintaining that right of way. Do you see the concern that we were trying to address there? And I'm happy for some additional suggestions, but that's why we left it off, so that it stays on the adjacent property owner's responsibility and we don't transfer the liability back unnecessarily.
Yeah, and
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair Mears, and thank you, Representative Holland, for that clarification. So I wasn't thinking that it was going to necessarily require them to do something, but it requires them to make a decision knowing that a failure to act on their part doesn't mean the utility is going to come and do it. They're just saying there is a problem of such a degree that we feel like there is, you know, whether you call it an imminent concern of contact with a line or a wildfire concern, but I'm thinking of trees, you know, large trees leaning the wrong way, and not necessarily saying we're going to come and cut it.
Okay.
But we're giving you a heads up that we've noticed this. This is, maybe we're willing to, with your blessing, come in and get it, but not in a sense that it would, you know, suggest that they're going to come in and do it. I do think there are probably things of such imminency that would justify an immediate action taken. But I can see a lot of situations, they're just routine investigation of right of way where they could identify a problem. And I don't quite know how to get that, but I'm trying to look at a way for them to give notice and maybe lift a weight of concern that we observe the leaning tree. It's a big one. And if the wind was just right, you know, that type of situation. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Co-Chair Holland.
Yep, through the chair. Thank you for the comments. We'll do some more work on this. I would note that the current language does allow the utility to act immediately if there's an immediate threat. And that's compatible with their current hazard danger tree program. Although we've actually helped, I think, helped the utility here, because right now, if they find a danger tree adjacent to the right of way, they have to try and work with the property owner and work through that. And we've provided a pathway. If they see imminent critical danger, they've got the okay in this legislation to just go take care of the tree. Particularly if we're in a red flag period of time where there's no time to go try and figure out who the owner is. Just get it down. Let's save the community from that. And that's why we also have the language that caps the liability. If for some reason someone came back and argued that you really didn't have to take down that dead, broken spruce tree hanging over the lines, that there would be a limitation on that. But to your point about the timeline, let's do a little bit more work on that, because the timeline is really pretty variable. If they were to find this hazard outside of the wildfire season, the appropriate timeline might be, you know, if they found it in August, get it done before April. On the other hand, if they found this hazard at the end of April and we're just going into the peak of the wildfire season and dry grass, that time frame might be very short. So let me do some work with you, and perhaps the utilities will come back and give us some additional comments on what that clock might be, again, with the concern. I don't want to inadvertently push the liability back to the utility, that if the adjacent property owner doesn't do it in that time frame, mm-hmm. I don't want the monkey to be back on the utility's back. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I think that would bring up a liability that hadn't previously been identified before beforehand. So you're setting up, hey, I noticed this and I'm not doing anything about it.
To the chair, that's been the underlying biggest challenge of this bill, is if we begin identifying hazards, if the person who identified it knows about it, now we create some different liabilities that weren't there before. So there's been some concern about this idea that we're going to recognize a hazard, communicate it to somebody. Now you've got the question of, does the person who owns that property, how do they handle the liability that they've been noticed? But on the other hand, if the person who created the notice says, we know about this hazard, but nothing happens, regardless of whether or not it was necessarily ours, you know, does that push back on us in some way? And that's been a really interesting issue for us to try and thread. And I don't think we're quite finished with trying to find the right balance in that. The other thing I would just generally note at a high level is the plans that are being described here in terms of wildland fire mitigation plans. While it is new in our discussion in Alaska, this is a very well-established set of statutory language in the western United States. Utah was one of the early states following California that really worked on this, but then Montana and Idaho, Washington, Oregon are all working on this. So this is a lexicon of having these kind of plans, like we're all generally familiar with community wildfire protection plans now. Utility wildfire mitigation plans is a new outgrowth of that. But what is new in Alaska, and I want to, you know, own this is going a step further than the language that has been proposed in the other states by this notion that if the utilities have gone through and worked on their right of ways and they've observed or identified adjacent hazardous vegetation, we need to do something about it. The other laws don't have that on there. They just say, take care of your right of way. Doesn't matter what you see, just keep the blinders on. And I recognize they have some hazard danger tree areas. So we are pushing the boundaries a little bit on this, and that is creating some inadvertent or unintended consequences that are requiring us to navigate this liability transfer issue more carefully.
And before we get on to next question from Representative Costello, I do want to note that we do have two of our Rail Belt utilities available for testimony today, and I'm sure they'll be very happy to answer a lot of these technical questions and situations that they've had to deal with and some of those practical concerns as well. Representative Costello, and also welcome Representative Johnson.
Thank you. As I'm sitting here, I'm having flashbacks to college, learning about John Locke and why it is that we enter into society and government, which is the main reason is protection of private property. And I think what I'm thinking about here is the relationship between the utility and the homeowner, because we all know what a right-of-way is, and yet this bill will then extend responsibilities really to the utility to go beyond the right-of-way into the private property owner's purview in order to address an imminent threat to a wildfire. So it, to me, it's interesting because, and you did just mention that in other states that that line has been sort of softened now, because in this bill, the utility can go in if they see an imminent threat. How do you envision a utility knowing what an imminent threat is and having that ability? It seems to me that by virtue of the fact that we're asking that a mitigation plan be put together, that there are experts in that area. So how do you envision the utilities having that expertise, and what would an imminent threat look like? And then after, let's say, a homeowner's tree is removed by the utility, what are the next steps? Because I see the relationship as part of the concern here between the homeowner and the utility that now is going to have statutory authority to come in and actually take action where they see the need, and then possibly be held liable if they don't take action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do you want to take this one?
For the record, Tim Truer, staff representative Kai Holland. Through the chair, Representative Costello, I think that is a great question for the utilities and how they would interpret that language. I wouldn't necessarily venture an answer on how they would interpret it and whether the language is appropriate for them. But I will say that my education on this topic has been steep, and I've learned a lot talking to the utilities. And I've been, as a general statement, I've been very impressed by the work that they do to keep Alaskans safe from wildfire risk.
Okay. Representative Costello?
So does the bill define imminent threat currently?
To the chair, no, it doesn't. And I think it's also fair, your observation about the level of technical expertise to identify the hazard of the vegetation is an issue that the utilities have brought up. So I hope that they'll share a little bit more about that concern and how we might address that. The other thing I just want to make note of, because you're bringing up this issue of the responsibility or opportunity that utilities have to look at this vegetation adjacent to the right-of-way. I believe current G, does that still have the 300-foot line in there? Yeah. So current version you have in front of you has this 300-foot distance beyond the right-of-way. And we've recognized in discussions that that's too much. So we're going to be pulling that way back. Now we're trying to figure out what is that adjacent distance. The intent is some language that we've been working on that essentially looks for vegetation that is in close enough proximity that it could contact the lines. Because we recognized, to your point, Representative Costello, and through the chair, that asking utilities to go some distance into private property creates no end to concerns, and that was not our intent, to create that kind of interaction of the utilities going into private property. So we're trying to figure out how to carefully construct a very limited scope of adjacent vegetation that could and might create a hazard condition, but there's some technical questions of who decides and has the expertise to make that determination. So again, we'll go back maybe to the utilities, maybe touching on that today.
Kind of depends on where you are and how tall the trees are too.
Exactly. Yep.
Thank you, Representative Costello. You look done with that line of questioning, but Representative Ruffridge is ready to go. Yeah. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Mears. I had similar concerns to my colleague from Anchorage. When we look on this section that's in front of us here, I think that's on page 5 of the work draft B. It starts on page 5. I think it's letter F. It has this language in here about imminent and high risk of making contact with utilities, real or personal property, and causing a fire to ignite. This is the line: the utility may remove the vegetation immediately and without notice. I find it interesting here that the word is may remove it. This section seems to be indicating in section 3 that they have a requirement to develop a fire mitigation plan, and that there is a removal of liability if they have the plan. But then if you have may language here, what, let's say they identify these things and they may remove it, but they choose not to. Would they then have liability? I'm confused by how that section is written.
Representative Holland.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I guess the first part of that is that the utilities currently have a fairly robust, well-established danger hazard tree program. And so the language may is both providing them the opportunity to take immediate action if that is what they feel like is appropriate. There's a tree right there ready to fall on the lines. But this was also set up so that they could continue using and following their hazard danger tree program, which gives them the latitude to go contact the property owner, explain what's going on, seek permission. And we didn't want to circumvent their existing hazard danger tree program. But we did want to open up the door that if they see a problem, that they wouldn't be precluded from being able to act immediately. And it could be that we, you know, need to bring legal in at some point to help us with some nuancing of the language to make sure that we're getting that intended. But that was the intent there, was take action if you have to preserve safety and not burn our community down. But on the other hand, with the May language, letting them follow procedures that they have and good relationships they're trying to maintain with adjacent property owners.
Okay.
Follow up.
I think you had said that there was a number of states that have something similar. I actually looked for language like that. From what I can tell, kind of to the point again from Representative Costello about John Locke, I don't see any state in the United States that allows a company, regardless of what that company is, to have request to enter your private property to remove a piece of your private property. That's really surprising to me. Are you aware of a state that allows that?
Commissioner Holland?
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. Thank you for the question and the opportunity to clarify what maybe I didn't say earlier. What I outlined earlier was a number of Western states have wildfire mitigation plans and have that language, and you can do a search and you'll find Utah, Montana, Idaho. You know, each state has wildfire mitigation plans. What I hoped I said, but I'll try and say it clearly, is that our legislation here uniquely is going beyond the existing legislation that exists in providing some new language around the utility's involvement in adjacent property vegetation. So you're absolutely correct in your observation that other states don't have language around what to do in adjacent vegetation. That is what we've introduced here that has taken us a step beyond. So,
a follow-up to that, if I may?
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you. In sort of researching this language, I would find it surprising if there wasn't some sort of legal boundary that we're crossing here, pun intended. Even if this language is in the statute, I think that there's some other sort of barrier here that would still prevent a utility from crossing a very real boundary property line and taking an action. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't this lead to just trouble, lawsuits, mm-hmm. things like that?
Co-Chair Holland.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Mears, to Representative Ruffridge. It's a fair question. We'll take it back to legal and ask them to provide a little bit of analysis on where that line is and what impacts we're creating on that. I know we've had some discussion with them on different aspects of this bill. I don't know that we have existing legal opinions specifically on how to understand that nuance, particularly as it relates to imminent hazard to the community that we're trying to address here. But we'll seek a legal opinion and come back and share it with the committee.
Thank you, Co-Chair Holland. Representative Kopp, did
yes.
I see you?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Mears. Representative Costello certainly brings up great questions regarding the right-of-way. I think, you know, the right-of-way, particularly the Alaska Railroad's right-of-way, is something I've had great interest in for over a decade. And during that time, it's come, you come square into the common law doctrine of necessity, which comes into play here, which is why every state would not have to have it spelled out in statute what a utility can do, because that doctrine of necessity for someone who owns an easement would apply to go outside of that easement if a situation, in this case, fire damage or infrastructure damage, was of such an immediate nature and was so serious and no reasonable alternative existed that and their response was proportional to what they're seeing. So it's all based on a doctrine of reasonableness. It's just our common law is set up to allow things that normally would not be permitted, but you have a defense of necessity as long as you can articulate that it was of an immediate nature, it was very serious, and your response was proportional to what you saw. So I think there's the common law covers utilities in those situations, which may explain why not every state would have this set up, because it already is fundamentally in the law in those types of situations. But it's really a really good question. I think we could get too prescriptive and almost do away with the common law, where I think it's kind of nice to, but again, Ledge Legal could give us a thought on that.
Yeah. I got to jump in a little bit first, because I think there are, circumstances are changing a little bit more with our wildfire dangers are increasing, and there is concerns about liabilities to distribution lines for electric utilities. And so there's some of that landscape is literally changing. Right. And just clarifying that there is a path forward is sometimes, I think, what we're trying to do here in an important context. Co-Chair Holland.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair. I mean, a couple of quick comments on this, and I appreciate the dialogue. In the current construction of the statutes, the only time the utility would be going into that adjacent, potentially private property is in the case of this imminent danger of a tree, where they decide that in good judgment, this needs to be done because otherwise we're going to start a fire. The rest of the work that's outlined in this wildfire mitigation plan is intended, including their assessment of adjacent vegetation, is that they're not going into the private property to do that. That's why we need to pull back on that 300-foot line. The intent is they stay within the right-of-way and do this assessment work. It's only if this danger tree, hazard tree situation came up that they might have to. And your comments, Representative Kopp, I think are appropriate towards necessity and common law may apply. The other thing I wanted to mention, though, is that we uniquely, and this was an early request, have within the statutes here the option where a utility may and an adjacent property owner may choose to enter into a voluntary agreement to allow the utility to help manage the vegetation. And this was specifically brought up in the case of utility lines going through public property, could be state park or municipal land, where it would be beneficial to say, between a utility and a park owner, to say, if you're in there doing vegetation management, we're going to enter into a voluntary plan. So if you see a problem, just go fix it and give that permission, but use that written plan to provide that mechanism to do that. That could also be used in private property if somebody wanted to. But again, this is completely at the discretion of the utility and the private property owner to enter into that plan if they wanted to. And there's nothing in it that indicates that the utility is doing this at any cost to themselves only. If they entered into that plan, there would, I anticipate, also a negotiation of the cost of doing any of that work. So this is not intended to add any new cost to the utility. The whole intent behind all of this was the utilities are already assessing their right-of-ways. They're already taking care of their right-of-ways. We just want any information that they gather that shows a risk get shared with adjacent property owners. But we're not asking them to do any of the work.
So speaking of the utilities, shall we have them come up and we can ask them questions directly? Or do we have anything further for Co-Chair Holland and Mr. Truer? I see you just flipped a slide, so we're not done with that, are we?
We've gotten through the hard part, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. A couple more slides. If
a little bit more. All righty.
For the record, Tim Dreher, staff for Representative Kai Holland. Moving on to slide six. No changes were made to these sections aside from what was previously mentioned on the summary slide. Moving on to slide seven, section eight concerns the diversified portfolio standard in the bill. I did explain most of the changes to this section in the summary slide, so I won't dwell on them here, but we can stop for questions if folks would like, but I recognize that we want to get the utilities speaking also.
Not this time.
Okay. Slide eight. Again, minimal changes to these sections of the bill. I'll just note that for the statute, section 11 is the statutory portion of the state energy policy. Again, reflecting input from a stakeholder, we clarified that in regards to a goal surrounding energy efficiency, we added language that clarifies that that includes efficiency of electricity generation and transmission, not just the efficiency of electricity end uses. And slide nine. And finally, so we this is just an overview of the sections that were pulled out of the bill, again, addressed in the summary slide. Notably, plug-in solar, portable solar generation devices, section two from version A was pulled out. Economic development rate, section three was pulled out. And then section 12 and 13, which referred to the previous role in version A of the Department of Environmental Conservation in determining whether certain energy projects counted as diversified energy projects, was changed to an activity for a third party. So those sections were removed. And that's the end of the presentation.
Excellent. Do we have any more questions at this time? All righty then. We've spent a lot of time talking about them. Now let's talk to them. We do have invited testimony. First up, we've got Julie Esty from Matanuska Electric Association, and then we will have Rob Montgomery from Homer Electric online. But Ms. Esty, welcome to House Energy Committee Room. Am I in? Thank you for joining us here today, and please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Co-Chair Mears, Co-Chair Holland, and the rest of the committee. Great to be here. My name is Julie Esty. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer at Matanuska Electric Association. And I do want to just highlight that Rob Montgomery is coming behind me. So you don't have to use all your questions up on me. He'd be happy to answer a few as well from Homer Electric. As most of you know, sitting around this table, it's a pretty esteemed group of folks who have been involved in energy for a while. We're navigating a really quickly shifting landscape at the utilities. It's happening globally with geopolitical and technology pushing change faster than most can adapt, and especially here in Alaska, where we have unprecedented transition away from our standard, at least on the rail belt, natural gas from Cook Inlet and looking to other options of energy. So that's where we sit here today. And we're doing that as cooperatives. And that's also unique. You know, there's most folks dealing with issues this large are investor-owned utilities with profits and shareholders and different types of resources. As co-ops, we both, I think, our local control as well as our nonprofit status, not-for-profit status, is one of our biggest strengths, but is also an Achilles heel, can be an Achilles heel as we navigate these things. As we look at the legislation that's come before us and that's being considered, I think it's clear that the legislature and other stakeholders also want to be helpful in this transition. And I think, a big question is, what is the role? How can you all be helpful? What is the role of not just the legislature, but the government in this? And what will actually move the needle on some of these really big picture issues? The gas question is the big elephant in the room right now, and what we're really working and focusing on. It's like the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We're really focused on that shelter, food, and water right now. But these kinds of discussions, looking beyond that, kind of around the elephant in the room, are worthy and important discussions to have as well. We also have ahead of us significant investments as we start to secure our future. And as MEA, as a co-op, we're looking at our 58, we just hit the 58,000 member mark. So any investments we make, we have to divide that by 58,000. That's the amount that we have to pay for those big investments. So we've talked about affordability around this room and around the dais, and it is a key thing on each one of our minds as well. The sponsor statement also spoke to the high cost of energy in Alaska. That is especially true in rural Alaska, but we are also above national average, although the national average is creeping up on us slowly in the rail belt as well. So as we look at these solutions, we know we're going to have to make some big investments in just the energy transition that we're looking at. And as we look at some of these other smaller pieces to fill in those gaps, we need to ask what impacts will those have on cost as well. We do have concerns with House Bill 369 because we do believe some of the provisions currently in the bill will increase costs to our members, and I'll detail some of those as well. And we're concerned that even as I said, we're looking kind of beyond the elephant in the room, none are going to solve the big problems at hand. But having said that, it does address this bill, a long-term vision and legislative intent, which are really important discussions for us to have. And, you know, I know the other conversation we've had and I've been hearing around this table is around the reduction of bills, not just the cost of power, but how do we actually reduce members' bills? And I think that's also a worthy discussion. But I think it's important to clarify that doesn't necessarily mean a reduction of costs to provide that power. So really, as we think about if you're decreasing the cost of power or the bills to one set of consumers, the cost of providing that power to everybody remains the same. And so the folks that you're not reducing those bills for are just paying more for that power. And until the RCA is able to provide flexibility on rate structures, when you reduce bills for one group, the costs for others rise. Hawaii is an excellent example of this. We had a policy tour. It was incredibly inspiring, but also there were some good lessons learned there. In talking to some of the consumers, in fact, one of the commissioners, similar to RRCA, their PUC commissioner, was talking about his solar panels and how not only is he getting money from the power being sold, but at certain times of day, they pay more because it's more valuable. And so that's an excellent example about how he is taking advantage of these programs to reduce his costs. However, Hawaii also has some of the highest rates in the state. And so those costs just shift naturally. And so as we're considering bills, I think looking at costs and how they are allocated to folks is really important as well. Again, we appreciate the long-term vision and aspirational focus of this bill and the leadership in getting it out on the table for discussion. And we appreciate being brought to that table as utilities to have that voice be heard. And while I said it, not that it will solve any of sort of the big pressing problems, what that I feel like it means is that we can take our time and make sure we get this right. And so I really appreciate the thoughtful questions going on around the table. You guys are all very invested in this bill and Alaska's energy future, and that's much appreciated. And it sets the stage, I think, for further discussions. There's things going on outside as well, like the integrated resource plan is getting started. The RTO just had their hearing and we'll be hearing about those results as well to remove wheeling. They're important building blocks as we set the stage for what's in the future. In addition to those big changes, the utilities are also one thing I think that's important to recognize. Utilities are also in the midst of a bunch of changes from previous legislation. We're in the middle, again, as I said, of the integrated resource plan. We are not only developing standards, but some of those have now been approved by the RCA, including the cybersecurity and cybersecurity standards. And so we're now implementing changes to make sure we're in compliance with those standards. We're doing a lot of work with the RTO. We're implementing community solar. So there's a lot of things happening right now. And we just, MEA would like to urge the legislature to focus the attention on what's on that Maslow's hierarchy on what's going to be making a difference into the future. It's a significant time for change for the utilities. So specific comments on version G of House Bill 369. First, I just wanted to say a big thank you to both Tim and Aiden in Representative Holland's office and the bill sponsor. You all have taken an incredible amount of time, at least I know with me personally and in talking to my colleagues around with the other utilities. And while we haven't had the opportunity yet to place things on the record, we have felt heard. And conversations that we've had with staff have been implemented in version G. So we just want to really express appreciation to staff and the bill sponsor for that. This version, we do feel like version G is improved over version A. So thank you for that. I'm just going to go generally section by section. Feel free to stop me at any point with all your good questions. The first section really identifies the some legislative intent, which I really appreciate the clarity on getting that legislative intent. Sometimes we divine it from something that one person says. This part of the bill really lets the legislature speak as one around their intent around some of these things, which will be helpful as we move forward. We appreciate the renewed focus on energy efficiency, which is critical for Alaskans. It's unclear in the current version of the bill how that will be measured and also whose responsibility it is to achieve those results. So we hope future versions will clarify that as well. We appreciate the addition of recognizing the value of supply side efficiency. Those are the things the utility can do either through sharing our generation like we do with the Chugach Power Pool or improvements to transmission and other items to really, we can decrease the amount of gas we spend just on working our current generation stack better or making improvements to that. So we appreciate that in the bill as well. And also the continued recognition of the reality and the value of the fossil fuel industry to the heart of our state. We also appreciate the focus on affordability. And we, as we survey our members, their primary priorities are reliability first and affordability as a close second. And pretty much everything else is a distant third, fourth, fifth, and sixth. And so potentially there could be some considerations for receiving legislative intent around reliability of our systems as well. Moving on to section two, the vegetation and electric contact. This has received a lot of conversation already, and it's no secret that the utilities and our partner with the Alaska Power Association have been working to limit utility liability for vegetation outside of our easements for a few years now. For instance, for MEA, there was a fire in our service territory caused by a tree, a very healthy birch, actually, outside our service territory that fell into our lines. It's nothing that we would have seen on a scan. The roots had been compromised by some industrial mining. And so we were in a process of dealing with frivolous lawsuits. And then it really goes down to whose insurance is paying at this point. So we appreciate the bill sponsor and the attempt to really reduce those frivolous lawsuits and really clarify the limited liability for things outside of our direct control. As we look at specific sections in 4205.086, just really clarifies, hey, this is the limit of liability. We don't have any significant issues with this section. It clarifies the liability. It requires us to have a wildland fire mitigation plan, which we do. And it makes clear that we're still liable if we do something negligent, which we should be. So both of those make sense to us. We would tweak a little bit of the language here and there, but we don't need to go into those details here, but happy to provide some more comments there. As we move into section three, where we get to 4205.352, that's really where the meat and potatoes of our concerns with this bill are, and MEA will be unable to support the bill if these sections remain intact. We view there's compliance issues, potential cost escalations, issues with property rights of our members, as has been talked about here, overreach of our powers, and also a lack of clarity. So just to dive into a few of those, this ties our plan to that of wildland plans for communities. And just something to put out there, a utility may serve many communities. MEA, for instance, serves both the municipality in Eagle River, and we also serve the borough, and we also serve the city of Wasilla and Palmer and Houston. Those are like the main jurisdictions. And those of you who know all of those different jurisdictions understand that they may have different priorities. They may have very different standards in place. And so one question that we have is, how do we rectify all of those different community plans if there are many within our service territory, and tying our plan to theirs, whether some choose to do it or not, and how they may dovetail or not, or be disparate, is important for us to understand and gain some clarity in the bill. Section B is one of the more problematic areas of the bill. We talked about that 300 feet. That is significant. And so it's great to hear the bill sponsor, Co-Chair Holland, indicate that that is looking to be changed. Our rights to anything stop at the easement lines. And so as we view it, anything beyond those easement lines is beyond our legal authority to go to. So we look forward to changes in the bill that hopefully really narrow that to really what is within our control. Those easements are contracts that we have with our members and private landowners. And so to go beyond those would be significant breach of those contracts and require significant work on our part to make those adjustments. It requires decision-making outside of our expertise about what hazards are and mitigation efforts. Adds requirements well beyond the capacity of our current staff. MEA is actually really well staffed for our vegetation management. We have 12 people working on vegetation management, and we also hire contractors. That's because we have 4,800 miles of line, which almost is double of any other utility. So those folks are very busy as it is, and looking at the responsibilities requested in this bill, we would have to increase that significantly, resulting in additional costs. Again, there's varied impact here. We have 4,800 miles of line. Others have much less. Much of our line is rural, spread out. We don't have a lot of density, and very difficult to access. So some of the requirements are really onerous for us. We currently do work with our landowners as much as possible. As Co-Chair Holland said, we have a pretty robust danger tree program as it is. And we identify hazards and work to see them. We work to mitigate them as we can. But having the requirements that exist in this bill is a mismatch between reasonable actions and the costs and benefits. It also, one of our big concerns, which has been talked about here and I appreciate, is it gives us the rights to infringe on the property rights of our members and other property owners, which is a really slippery slope. So we do prefer the language in some of the other states where it really just limits our actions to what's in the easements, what's contractually obligated by our utility to the folks that we serve, or landowners if they're not our members. We want nothing to do with taking immediate action on landowners if we see an issue. We have had, and you know, when the McKinley fire was happening, we allocated some of our vegetation management staff to the folks with DNR, and they did take down trees to create fire breaks in the midst of an emergency. And so under the direction of DNR, our folks did that, but as far as from the utilities perspective, that is beyond the scope of our legal agreements. So moving on away from, I'm going to move away from the fire, wildland fire planning and prevention. So if there's any questions there and folks want to stop me, let me know, but I'm going to move to section 4 now.
Ms. Essie, I was thinking that you'd finish your testimony and then we can start jumping into stuff.
I will continue then.
Keep your train of thought going.
Great. Okay, so Section 4 is the cost recovery of small projects. We do appreciate the reduction to 7 megawatts. MEA supports local control by local co-op boards, but not if there's negative impacts to the neighboring utilities. 7 megawatts allows those projects to stay on the distribution system, which is a valid limit for what's locally should be locally controlled by a board. Beyond that, where it could get into transmission level, we feel like that could be problematic for other boards. And if there's just one board making that decision and does not have to consider the rest of the boards, we feel like that 7 megawatts is a good number. We are concerned about this because we do feel like it could open up room to game the system, whether either overachieving limits set by the RRC process or through contracts like our power pool agreement. So we strongly advocate an amendment for an aggregate limit to that, so that say if you get to 20 megawatts total of projects, you have to go to RCA. Again, it doesn't stop a project from going. It just gives that double check to make sure that somebody is not abusing the system. And, you know, as far as just what this is for, we have not seen a problem. We have about 8 to about 10 contracts with independent power producers that we've run through the RCA and have had no delays. It's not a significant or onerous job, and we appreciate their ability to double check. I think when you remove the RCA from the process, the RCA provides transparency. It provides an ability for ratepayers to intervene or other parties to intervene. And when you remove that, the only opportunity that you have to resolve conflict then becomes the courts. And so the RCA is a valuable resource. And while, you know, if there's, we don't want to have undue regulation, keeping that check and balance is valuable. So moving on to Section 5, the IRP providing options to satisfy. We're excited about the IRP process with, you know, players having equal voice, a cadre of subject matter experts paid for to come up with the right answer and the greatest value obligation of the RRC. We hope that the committee will let the process work and let the IRP identify which projects are of the most value to the rail belt. Moving on to Section 6, there's a segment in there that has kind of lived throughout a couple of the RPS iterations, and which would not allow pre-approval of a project if it was detrimental to a utility achieving the DPS. And we would like to ask that be amended to add unless it is necessary to meet reliability standards or other reliability concerns. There may be a need to construct a small project that may not meet the confines of the DPS, but is necessary for some other reason to serve our contractual obligations. So we would ask for that consideration as well. Moving on to the DPS in Section 8, we really appreciate the changes that were reflected here over conversations that happened last year and into this. There was no official utility testimony on record about the RPS, but we can see our concerns reflected in the revisions here, and we appreciate that as well. MEA's board is really supportive of diversification, and we hope that instead of the government picking winners and losers, we let economics and reliability decide. We appreciate the changes that the bill sponsor made to the IRP, letting that greatest value that's already established in statute be how decisions are made. From the milestones, right now it's 2036. We know that Chugach Electric has submitted comments indicating a preference for 2040. We would support that as well. And MEA also has our own board goal of 50% by 2050. And so either of those work, but 36 at this point, while we wish that we could have progress that quickly, it's unrealistic. We also appreciate the change to the language about renewable energy credits and counting energy regardless of who owns the environmental benefit. That is a big deal for the economic viability of projects. Currently, the utilities, in a need to maybe meet a future RPS standard, have really been trying to keep control of those renewable energy credits. By allowing those that power to count no matter who owns that benefit, we can either sell those ourselves and have those go back to the ratepayer, or we can allow them to go back to the project, making the project more economic. So that's a really big change that may not have been noticed, but it is a big reflection. We appreciate the multiplier in recognition of collaborative solutions during this energy transition. There's obviously the intent driven by both the RCA and the legislature through Senate Bill 123 forming the ERO. A lot of acronyms there, sorry. And so applying that multiplier for collaborative projects or larger projects where we can gain economies of scale is valuable as well. As far as adding the diversified energy resources, I appreciate acknowledging that there may be changes to the future of what we want to consider in the DPS. We believe that responsibility should rest in the power producer to say whether this meets the DPS, not necessarily the utility. So the person who is bringing, the developer who's bringing that project online, it may be a utility, but it could also be an independent power producer. So suggesting an amendment there. And then it seems like there was a lot of language that it appeared to be potentially trying to understand if mitigated coal could be an option. And MEA's board really supports the further investigation of mitigated coal and locally sourced responsible coal power. And so our suggestion is just to allow mitigated coal, which is carbon sequestered coal resources, instead of spinning up this new responsibility that seems to leave it in question. For the definitions about what it is, again, let's not pick winners and losers, but incentivize the IRP selected greatest value to really determine that path forward. We're going to have all the folks around the table. We're spending a lot of ratepayer money on this IRP. Let's let the system work and trust it. In sections 9 and 10, the Renewable Energy Fund changes, we support changes indicated to the Renewable Energy Fund. We also, as a quick aside, support funding the Renewable Energy Fund as far as going what we can do right now to actually move the needle. The projects of the Renewable Energy Fund represent something very specific and tangible that can move that needle forward. On section 11, it was great to see the renewed focus on the energy policy. I was working for the Alaska Center for Energy and Power when all of that work was done by Representative Edgman and his colleagues on forming that energy policy. So it's great to see a renewed focus on it. We appreciate, again, the addition of the focus on energy efficiency. And I saw the line in there on the comprehensive and coordinated approach. And so the MEA is very much focused on collaborative means in which to meet and address head-on the challenges that we have facing us. So we'd love to see more emphasis on this, even in the current version of the bill as well. For the timeline of the Wildland Fire Mitigation Plan, we do appreciate a 2028 timeline on that, even though the bill starts in 26. That will be a change and something new for the utilities. So acknowledging that through a couple extra years to get that together will be important. And with that, that concludes my testimony. Co-Chair Mears, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Esty. I noted your support in there for the Renewable Energy Fund on Tuesday. We did talk about that, and the co-chairs have sent a memo supporting the full funding with a couple of other, you know, potential benchmarks in there, but funding that list in order. So if anyone has other support on that, extending that beyond this committee would be useful. Co-Chair Holland?
Great. Thank you. Through the chair, thank you for being here today and sharing all the comments, feedback, and suggestions. They're all very valuable. I wonder if, in light of the conversation we had a few minutes ago about the issue about what do we do about vegetation that's adjacent to the right-of-way, we talked both about your, I believe, preference for just staying right in the right of way. But you also noted that you do have a danger hazard tree program, which suggests that you are looking out beyond that right of way to see what's there. And when you see something that's potentially a hazard, you're recognizing that and you're doing something about it. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about how does that process work, and can you help us figure out how to navigate this fine line of providing some guidance, some liability protection for your utility, but trying to be respectful of private property, but on the other hand, you don't want the people doing the inspection or running drones or whatever to put blinders on and not look at what's 6 inches away from there. And you are doing it. So how are you navigating that issue right now that allows you to look at private property and then do something? And how could that help us inform what we might put into this guidance and structure?
Thank you for the question, Co-Chair Holland, through Co-Chair Mears, I think is how it goes. that's a great question. And I think it's a really fine line. And where we continue to go back to is our legal rights, which are only within the easement. The Danger Tree program that we have is for members who see things beyond the line to contact us. We then will go out to their property. It is, you know, on their property and look to see if it is actually a threat to our line, or if maybe they just want us to take a tree down for them and make sure that we're spending our money, our members' money, wisely. So the Danger Tree program is a proactive measure that members can take to highlight potential dangerous trees on their own property and ask us to take them down for them. And so we are very aggressive about our advertisement for that. If you have a danger tree, let us know. We have had instances where neighbors report their neighbors' danger trees, and then we do what we can to connect with that neighbor. And you know, there are areas of risk in our service territory. For instance, there was the Sockeye fire maybe over a decade ago now. Maybe it wasn't that long ago, maging myself. And there are charred trees. You can, when you drive up to Talkeetna, you see them on the Parks Highway. And so in those instances, we have, where there is a large swath of trees, we have gone to FEMA and said, hey, we would love to have some funding to help take care of this large issue, not this one single tree, but this kind of large, broad issue. And then we worked with landowners to see if they would give us approval. Interestingly, even though they're just these charred little spindly trees, we had less than 50% of the landowners that took us up on participating in that program. And we weren't able to get the funding from FEMA because we didn't have landowners that would cooperate. So it is a real issue, especially out in the valley and probably out in the Kenai as well, where there are large swaths of land and people value their privacy and their land rights. So I don't have the perfect answer for you, Co-Chair Holland, but that is how we handle it. We are very strict with what is within our right of way. That is all we have legal rights for. And then if property owners proactively contact us, we'll make sure that we can.
Thank you, Co-Chair Holland.
Great. Thank you. I'd like to follow up on that. And your comment about the member initiating the tree program is really valuable. Thank you for providing that clarification. But I do want to go back to kind of the premise of the question. Assuming you're doing inspection of your right of way, whether that's somebody on the ground doing that or your other assessment methods, if you see some dangerous vegetation mm-hmm. adjacent to your right of way, do you take action or not? And if you do, how do you do it?
I think that's a great question. And I would, you know, I'm happy to get my tree, the vegetation management guys to know exactly how that happens. I do think that there are opportunities to work with landowners, but we also have a very focused team. And so we do have sky trims that not only take out the trees, but can take out roots and things hanging into the easement. And that has actually, one, sped up our work, made it a lot safer for our vegetation management crews, and also allowed us to get some of those hangers that may be rooted outside the easement, but their limbs and or their tops are dangerously over. So we have employed technology to try to reduce that. I think the concern with the bill is making that the requirement of the utility all of a sudden increases the liability mm-hmm. because, again, 4,800 miles of line is a lot. And it's expensive to be clearing all of those right-of-ways. And so we do some of it at ourselves. We have some of it with crews. And they are very focused on the work at hand. And they know they're not supposed to go outside their ribbons that they place along the easement. And so while some things may be noticed and can be addressed, all things will definitely not be noticed. And we have concerns with a bill that would place liability for things that maybe don't get noticed in 4,800 miles of line with dense forest, place additional liability on our members for that.
Thank you. Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, thank you. I'm wondering, so obviously you do a lot of work on the mitigation of the right-of-way. Do you have a cost for that right now, just in the work that you do, just ballpark?
Absolutely we do, and I don't have it with me. But I can come back to the committee probably by the time Rob is done speaking. I can get that okay. To the committee.
Thank
aid.
You.
Yeah.
My second question, if there's no others.
Co-Chair Holland.
Great. Thank you. One other clarification question through the co-chair. On Section 6, you mentioned a possible change or addition about clarifying unless the change is required for meeting reliability. Mm-hmm. And I just want to clarify because Section 6, as I believe it's currently focused, is really looking at large energy facilities, which are defined as, I think, greater than 15 megawatts. I'm assuming that this reliability exception probably is for smaller projects than a large facility, but are you thinking that this reliability exception would include large facilities?
Co-Chair Holland, through Co-Chair Ramirez, yes, it could. And in previous iterations, folks with far more technical expertise than myself have indicated that especially if we see an increase in inverter-based resources, variable power like wind and solar, mm-hmm. we could need some sort of inertia or other project to help with power quality or other reliability issues. And so in their technical opinion, again, not mine, there could absolutely be a 15 plus megawatt project that could be necessary from a reliability standpoint that may not meet the needs of the DPS.
Thanks for the clarification.
And I imagine that, I mean, we're not just talking about generation changing, we're also looking at demand changing. So that can change our balance and our formulas absolutely. Here as well. So you plan something today and somebody builds something new and you're like, well, that's not what I planned for.
Absolutely. So we've got to be prepared to serve.
Excellent. That's all the questions we have at the moment for the committee. I appreciate you going to look that information up for Representative Ruffridge in the moment. Thank you for being in the room and being able to come back to us in a few minutes. So we do have Rob Montgomery on the line from Homer Electric Association. Please, thank you for joining us, and please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Sure. For the record, my name is Rob Montgomery. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Homer Electric. I'll just start by saying, you know, I think Julie did a great job of covering a lot of the details throughout the legislation. And I think that we're aligned on many of the points that she made. So my testimony will be more brief, and I'll focus on a few areas, two or three areas. I would like to mention, I think Julie made a great point about our industry and the environment here in Alaska. We're going through significant changes, and we've got a number of decisions and investments that we'll have to make as utilities as we move forward. And I think it's going to be important for the collaboration with the state, with the other utilities, for us to make decisions that are in the best interest of our members. And you know, for Homer Electric, we're a little different than the other rail belt electric cooperatives. And what I mean by that is we're a little smaller. So we face some challenges that maybe some of the larger ones do not face. We average about 13 members per mile on our system, and I think two gaps being the largest, I think they're somewhere around 70 members per mile. So there's a big difference there. We have a lot of terrain that we cover, and we have a lot of power lines. Julie mentioned, I think, that they have over 4,000 miles. We maintain about 2,600 miles of line. So we're smaller. We face some challenges from a financial standpoint that maybe some of the others don't, but I know they face challenges as well. So going back to this legislation, I'll just start by saying we really do appreciate the work of this committee and the legislature, and we appreciate the intent of this bill. And we know that you are working as a group to improve the electric service across the state. But we still have some concerns with the bill, and particularly around the wildfire liability. As it stands, would not support legislation that carries the responsibility outside the edge of the right-of-way. I think Julie had commented that that's an area that we cannot control. We do not have control. And we have no issue with doing the mitigation plan, but that mitigation plan should be focused on the property within the right-of-way. I mentioned the 2,600 miles of power lines that we maintain. If you add any additional property or responsibility on top of the right-of-way, it will absolutely and expand our liability on the issue. And it will also drive up cost. And ultimately, that finds its way to rates. So when you look at the right-of-way issue, you know, there are also challenges with having access. Many of the properties that we are adjacent to with our right-of-ways, they have, they're fenced, they're surrounded by fencing. There are other obstacles that may get in the way as well. And then the requirement of communicating with property owners, that's a challenge that we face today. When we do see what we call a hazard tree that's on adjacent property, we do make efforts to contact the property owner because we live in a state like Alaska, whether the property owner is a snowbird or they don't even live in Alaska at all, but they own the property, we have found it very difficult at times to reach those property owners. So there are some challenges there as well. There's been some discussion around the language with the wildfire liability, some of it being vague and needing more clarification. I think there was discussion earlier about imminent threat and what that actually means. There's other verbiage that we noticed as well when you talk about timely written notice. What does that mean? And how is notification verified? Talks about a reasonably foreseeable cause. What does that mean? And who defines it? There's a section that says that the utility has substantially complied. So how is compliance determined, and who makes that determination? So those are some of the things, just a few examples, and there's some other areas in there as well with language that we think would need further clarification. We also have some concerns about the requirement of notifying property owners of a fire risk that's on their property. The communication piece is one part, If you are reaching out to property owners and you're trying to track and maintain records, that's going to add additional administrative duties for the utility. And again, that will also come with a cost. So for ATA, you know, the bottom line is a utility's responsibility really does end at the end of the right-of-way. And any mitigation plan, as I said earlier, should only address those areas inside the right-of-way. And if anything else beyond that really would need legal clarification, and I think that was discussed earlier as well. So, you know, I'll turn my attention to the diversified portfolio standard. And we do appreciate the changes that have made from the earlier versions. You know, I listened into a committee meeting 2 or 3 weeks ago, and there was discussion about making sure whatever decisions get made, that we do not lose sight of reliability. At the end of the day, you know, outside of safety, keeping the lights on is the most important thing that we do. So as we look to a diversified portfolio standard, we should certainly keep that in mind, and we must make sure that we have dispatchable power. The other piece is, you know, when you look at a diversified portfolio standard, I know there had been discussion in previous sessions of a renewable portfolio standard. Well, diversified portfolio standard certainly gives utilities more decision-making flexibility. And at the end of the day, we see that as being a very good thing. With that said, there's a few things that we would like to recommend when it comes to the DPS. And I know Julie, and I think Tugach mentioned as well, as I heard earlier, in recommending the deadline move from 2036 to 2040. We certainly agree with that. We think moving it to 2040 or you know, even later will allow for longer lead times for some of the projects that we may be looking at. And I know just from a hydro standpoint, that can take up to 15 years for the permitting and for the construction to be completed. The multiplier, we agree with the multiplier. We would like to see it include battery energy storage systems to assist in bringing additional non-firm renewables onto the grid. So that would be another recommendation that we would make. And then we'd like to see, you know, the 100 megawatt threshold maybe be eliminated or lowered. We think that having such a high threshold does put limitations on some of the projects that you would look at. So really, at the end of the day, it's important that any legislation that's related to generation and the resources that we use as a utility, that we don't take the decision-making flexibility away from the utility's leadership and the board of directors. I know that we make our decisions here on the peninsula based on what's in the best interest, both operationally and financially for our membership. And so I do think it's important to have flexibility in the type of resources that we can choose from, that we make sure that, you know, I know when our board's making decisions, they're looking at what makes sense, what's going to keep the lights on, and what's going to be in the best interest of our members from a cost standpoint. So those are the things that from ATA's perspective that's important to us. And again, I do agree with the points, and we're aligned with the other sections of the legislation that Julie had covered in detail. So with that said, that does conclude my testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Montgomery. I'm going to start off with a couple questions based on some of our earlier conversation and poke into a little bit more about what you're doing now for your management and the right-of-ways and what kind of
costs that you invest in that?
Sure. Our inspection of our right-of-ways today, we actually patrol our lines on the ground and in the air. We are in the process of moving toward a drone program that would be used in our inspections. One of the things that we do, Julie mentioned the advertising and the outreach, public outreach that MEA does. We do the same thing here. We're very aggressive with the communications to our membership through social media, through advertising, wanting to make sure they understand that if they have a hazard tree or suspect that they have a hazard tree on their property, that they can call us and we will come out and meet with the property owner and assess it. And if it's determined that it is indeed a hazard tree, then we will take that tree down. So we are very proactive there. We also are proactive that when we use a contractor to maintain our right-of-ways, but our contractor is educated on our system, and we work with them so that if they identify any hazard trees that are outside the right-of-way, they inform HEA, and then we again make the attempt to reach the property owner. Most of the times we're successful in doing so. Sometimes we have a very difficult time getting in contact with the property owner. And, you know, a few years ago, when we were making contact with property owners, we had several that would not allow us to take trees off of their property, even when they were considered a hazard tree. The good news is that this past year, when we were doing public outreach, when we found or identified hazard trees on properties, that every property owner that we reached out to this past year did give us that permission. And in 2025, we actually took down over 7,100 hazard trees on our system. So the program has been very successful. We were able to take advantage of a couple of grants in 2025 that helped us with the mitigation of the hazard trees. And from a ATA perspective, we spend a minimum of $1.5 million every year on our right-of-way clearing and maintenance. So we see our program is being efficient, effective, and we are being more and more aggressive in our communications to the public in this particular area of managing our right-of-ways and in hazard trees on adjacent properties. So we will continue to do that as well, but we feel like we have made good strides and we'll continue to do so. So it's something that we make a part of our everyday work.
Thank you, Mr. Montgomery. I apologize. I was in the middle of another note when you gave your approximate budget for vegetation management in the right-of-ways. Could you repeat that for me?
Yeah, Homer Electric, we spend about usually $1.5 million or more on our right-of-way clearing and maintenance program annually.
Thank you very much.
Yep. I did the same thing.
Coacher Helen, do you have further questions on that?
I do. Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Montgomery, thank you for being here today. I want to follow up on a couple of the items we've discussed a little earlier. In your earlier comments, you mentioned that, you know, when you see a hazard tree, we do attempt to contact the owner or something close. And you mentioned here just a moment ago, it sounds like in some cases your contractor may identify a hazard tree. And one of the issues that we've been trying to explore and understand is this question of how do we ascertain the rubric or the qualifications of the utility or their contractors to be able to do that identification, and some concerns about whether or not they have the skills and the training to do that. I wonder if you could explain a little bit more about how your personnel or your contractors are being instructed to identify hazardous vegetation, a danger tree, to be able to make that determination and then trigger this notification process?
Through the chair. That's a good question, Representative Holland. On the Kenai Peninsula, in the past several years, it's been a little bit easier for our contractors and our own employees to identify a hazard tree simply because of the tremendous amount of beetle kill that we have here. So I would think when our contract crews and our employees are out, it is fairly easy for them to identify with these dying spruce trees that are adjacent to the right-of-way, to identify them as hazard trees. So I think our situation is probably a little different than maybe some of the other utilities and other geographic locations. But I would venture to say, and with subject to check, that nearly all of the trees that our contractors identify would be trees that are dying from beetle kill.
That's helpful. Thanks. A follow-up?
Thank you. Coach Holland.
Great. Thank you. I wanted to go slightly aside to that question. As you look at increasing the use of drones for the inspection, I'm wondering how that determination process will be done. And in particular, I'm recalling some information I've seen about doing drone-based vegetation assessment, and you end up getting a lot of information about the adjacent vegetation to the right-of-way. It just the imagery isn't limited, whether it's photographic or LIDAR, isn't limited to the lines of the right-of-way. And I'm just curious, how do you anticipate using that information and what you might gather in that assessment about the adjacent vegetation and what action you may take or how that'll trigger next steps in working with the property owners adjacent to your right-of-way?
Sure. Well, of course, the primary purpose, and again, I'm sorry, through the chair, the primary purpose of using the drones is to monitor our rights-of-way and to make sure that we are performing the maintenance and the clearing is there to identify any kind of potential hazards to our infrastructure. So we can use those drones to inspect our rights of way as we're doing today from the ground and from the air, and be much more efficient and we think cost effective as well. As far as how we're going about making the assessment, there are a number of utilities that already use drones and have a drone program. So we're talking to some of the different companies that do this type of service and making a determination. This is a conversation we began having last year. It is a direction that we want to move to. Again, because we think it would be more effective for us as a utility. Again, if we identify via any kind of drone footage of hazard trees on adjacent properties, then we would use the same process that we're currently using. We would identify the property owner, and then we would make attempts to reach that property owner. So that's the process we use today. Again, it's part of our everyday work that's being done by our contractors and our crews when they're in the field. And one other thing I will add is what we have started doing when we make the outreach to these property owners, if they refuse to give us the permission to take down a hazard tree on their property, we are having them sign a form saying that that they did not give us that permission, so that we do have a track record of it.
One more follow-up.
Thank you very much. One more, Representative.
Great. Thank you, through the chair. One last question, and I appreciate your time and sharing what you have. And this might also be a question for MEA and Ms. Estee, if she wants to. Kind of stepping back to the balcony, if we can, on this issue, the concern over wildfire danger in our communities and the concern over the catastrophic fires that we've seen, I think remains kind of a paramount reason why we're trying to struggle with this process. This is not, you know, motivated by trying to make life harder for the utilities. It's not motivated to add costs. And in essence, it's really motivated by reducing the cost to our communities and the risk that they face. It's motivated by reducing the potential loss of insurance. If we have areas where insurance agents, you know, say we're not going to insure this area, this is really motivated by how do we make our communities safer? And using all of the different tools and resources that we have. And one of those resources, maybe, is the fact that utilities are doing a significant amount of valuable work across our areas that have high wildfire danger. So the motivation here is how do we help everybody have a safer, lower cost community in the end and avoid what we've seen in other parts of the country and maybe not ever have it happen in Alaska if we've been proactive. And so on one hand, I, you know, appreciate very much the idea of just let us take care of what's in our right of way. But then, you know, what do we do about everything else is outside the right of way? Do we just ignore it because it's inconvenient and because we can't manage the liability? You know, I'm trying to avoid that, but, you know, so I guess the question for the moment with that in mind is, you know, if we were to look at this slightly differently and somehow remove the liability to utilities for fires that are caused by vegetation that came from outside the right-of-way. McKinley Fire would be an example. If we were to remove that liability magically with some statutory language, would that or how would that change what we might do in our the utilities management of the vegetation in the right-of-way and the right-of-way management? Would that change it at all?
Through the chair. I don't know that it would change it. I think we would have to see what that language looks like, Representative Holland, to have a better understanding. You know, I know from our utilities perspective that if you begin taking responsibilities outside of the right of way from a utilities perspective, you're only expanding the liability exposure of that utility. And then I think if you allow or you're looking to have utilities go on to private property, if they identify what they deem to be a hazard tree without getting permission from the property owner, I think, you know, and this was talked about earlier, I think we're opening up a whole nother can of liability type issues potentially. So for Homer Electric, I think we would have to see what that language looks like. We do understand your intent and the intent of the legislation and to help protect and reduce the exposure of liability for utilities, but without seeing the language and having a better understanding of it, I would be hesitant to comment further other than to say that anything that takes responsibilities outside the right of way, I think, increases the exposure for the utility.
I'll just clarify and wrap up.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. Through the chair, and just to clarify in wrapping up, the question I was asking was not intended to suggest in any way that utilities would be asked to do anything outside the right of way. Not going down there at all. That's clear. I was only looking at the question of, you know, you have a hazard tree program going on right now. You've cleared 7,100 trees last year. If there was this way of saying that vegetation outside the right of way, such as hazard trees, you're no longer liable or could be sued for the impact of that. Would that change what you did within the right of way? Wasn't asking you to go outside the right of way. So just curious.
Through the chair, I apologize for my misunderstanding, but You know, I don't know that it would change a whole lot of what we're doing within the right-of-way. No, sir.
That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll bring Ms. Esty back up because I think that you've got some input here as well as answering our earlier question. Do you have a clarification on that, Representative Ruffridge, or should we wait till after?
I just have a question for Mr. Montgomery.
Okay. Ms. Esty, since we're on that topic, you have
Julie
more
Esty
to add
for
to
the
it?
Record.
Thank you.
With NatNISC Electric Association, Co-Chair Holland through Co-Chair Mears. I think there was a couple questions in there. First of all, the utilities, MEA has a really solid right-of-way clearing program. We're aggressive. We are thorough. We invest. Here's the number, Representative Ruffridge. We invest $4.5 million minimum annually on our program. And having shield from liability for things outside of our control would not change any of those things that we do. In addition to managing our right-of-ways, we do currently have a very strong relationship with the folks at DNR and the fire program. We meet with them about joint potential projects around their fire breaks and maybe some of our distribution or transmission clearing needs. We've talked to them about our new integrated vegetation management plan around the vegetation that we put into our right-of-ways and working with them on creating shaded areas on the outsides of our right-of-ways. So there is a lot that we are still doing. We have a responsibility for the vegetation in our right-of-way. And if we're not doing it correctly, nothing should shield us from that. If we're negligent, we should be held responsible. But where we have no control outside of our right-of-ways, right now, that is just opens up risk to members for costs that they have no ability to control.
Thank you. Representative Ruffridge, you have a question for Mr. Montgomery?
I do. It's actually on the same, and I apologize, Mr. Montgomery. I had to leave for a few minutes there, so maybe it's something you addressed. Did you know what the cost is for HEA for their right-of-way mitigation?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, yes, sir. We spend approximately $1.5 million annually on our right-of-way clearing and maintenance program. Sometimes we have that supplemented through grants as we did in 2025.
Thank you. And I guess this will be a question follow-up, if I may, Madam Chair, for both of you. If you had to speculate, and that's what it would have to be, if you had to, let's say that the bill is changed and it's, let's say, 100 feet outside of your right-of-way, I imagine that number would have to grow up significantly in order to cover that, especially if there was a removal component of that. Could you even speculate what you feel like the cost would increase to that you would have to put into that each year?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, I would be hesitant to speculate on what that number is, but the point that you're making that it would certainly increase our cost for expanding onto adjacent properties, regardless whatever that distance may be, not only for the assessment part, but you know we're a small utility. We have one superintendent, and he oversees the work of our contract crews. For us to expand anything outside the right-of-way, whether it's keeping records for contacting property owners, maintaining, you know, any other type of tracking and records that we would need, we certainly would be needing more resources, and that would drive up costs.
Thank you. And just a final follow-up, if I may, just to the both of you. I guess, and this is maybe another difficult question to ask and answer, but I feel like I've lived in Alaska most of my life enough to know that I think there would be a potential safety issue to your workers if they were required to go into a private property, potentially one that is occupied by individuals, and begin some sort of work on someone's property without their consent. I mean, is that something that you feel comfortable speaking to? I feel like that we would put people in some sort of unsafe scenario potentially. And how would you go about mitigating that should we move forward with this language?
I'm going to jump on there quickly. Right-of-ways are on people's private property. So there's limits to that, but you are doing, you know, the utilities don't own that. They have the right and the access to it. Point taken, though, that if you're doing work that is not expected outside of that legal bounds, there'd be concerns of how a property owner would react to you when you're not allowed to be in that part of it. Mr. Wankheimer, do you have a further follow-up on that? Can we move on from that, Representative Ruffridge? Or you want to?
I guess my question was not about the right of way. It was about the component that I think we've kind of had questions about most of the afternoon here, which is removing items immediately and without notice, potentially outside of the boundaries of a right of way. And the safe, yeah. And if there would be a safety consideration there.
Yeah. Through the chair, I would like to answer the question. I think Representative Ruffridge, you're making a good point. Safety for our employees is always paramount. We're in a business, and particularly here in Alaska, that people are very private, and they are very careful about having people come onto their private properties. So it's absolutely something that we would want to take into consideration, just like we do today. Anytime we're doing work on someone's property, whether we're having to go on for a disconnection or for some other reason, and we have had occasion where we've had property owners that have challenged our employees. So is it a concern? Absolutely, it is.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. We're getting towards the end of our time, but I have a practical question for both of you. So my experience is in the civil engineering world, and from that experience, I know that, for example, in a road right-of-way, the road's not necessarily centered in that right-of-way. What is it like in the world of electric utilities? Is it either side of the line you've got 30 or 60 or 100 feet, or is it just sort of depend? How centered are your facilities to your right-of-ways?
Co-Chair Mears, typically we do try to center right in the middle of the right-of-way. Where the electrical right-of-way may be, say, right adjacent to a DOT right-of-way that's already cleared, we may shift that pole towards that right-of-way just to gain more space on either side. But traditionally, we run straight through the middle when we can.
Better than the civil engineers doing roads.
On the hillside where I'm at, we have your issue.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a dedicated right of way, but the lines cross. Sometimes they're close. Sometimes they're in it. Sometimes they're not.
Mr. Montgomery, what's your experience in Homer? How centered are your lines to your right of ways?
Through the chair, I would agree with Julie. We do a pretty good job of having it through the middle of the right of way and usually a fairly equal distance on either side of the line.
Thank you, because that matters.
It matters. And we did, over the last few years, Julie Esty, Matanuska Electric Association, we reclaimed the full width of our easements over the last decade. So, speaking to Co-Chair Holland's point, I think in the past, things were a little less clear, but now we've reclaimed the full width of our easements over the last decade through a pretty aggressive plan. And now center's always preferred.
Thank you. And since we've got two more minutes and I've got the gavel, what are some general widths of right-of-ways?
For distribution, traditionally, they're about 30 feet. So 15 on each side. Sometimes you'll get 40, but we try to minimize the impact to members when we're clearing those right-of-ways. For transmission, it's usually larger. 100 feet is preferred. With sometimes, you know, you'll get smaller right-of-ways from previous times when transmission poles were shorter, but all new transmission right-of-way, the goal is 100 feet.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for providing testimony today. As you see, we have lots of questions, and we really appreciate your feedback. With no more questions for today, we will now set this bill aside, and that concludes our business for today. Next week on Tuesday, we'll be hearing House Bill 328, Public Utilities Investment Surcharge, from Representative Kopp. And on Thursday, we have a presentation on the Alaska Energy Data Gateway from the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. Seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned promptly at 3 p.m. Thank you.